Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents On Account of Sex, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Making of Gender Equality Law by Philippa Strum. Narrated by Lisa Esware. Introduction. The marble plaza in front of the United States Supreme Court was a sea of black. Somberly garbed mourners filled the plaza itself, while others stood in hushed rows on the imposing set of steps leading up to the massive bronze front door. Inside the building, the doors to the courtroom were draped in black. Across First Street Northeast, the flags above the U.S. Capitol flew at half staff. It was September 23rd, 2020. 5 days earlier, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died of metastatic pancreatic cancer. It was her more than 100 former clerks who lined the courthouse steps as officers of the Supreme Court Police carried her casket into the building's great hall. They were there to mourn the first woman justice to be memorialized in the nation's highest tribunal. Television cameras in the great hall enabled the world to watch as Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt and Chief Justice John Roberts eulogized the late justice. Rabbi Holtzblatt, whose husband had clerked for Justice Ginsburg, would officiate 2 days later when another memorial ceremony was held inside the U.S. Capitol. There, Justice Ginsburg lay in state, the first woman and the first Jewish American to do so. There was an unprecedented outpouring of grief and respect across the nation. Flags were lowered in state capitals from Maine to Georgia. Citizens demonstrated quietly in towns, state capitals, and courthouses throughout the country, from Sacramento, California, to Boise, Idaho, and Concord, New Hampshire. Little girls, walking beside their parents, were dressed as the justice in her frilly white judicial collars and oversized round glasses. Little boys carried homemade signs with crayon sketches of the justice affectionately known as RBG. New York City renamed the Brooklyn Municipal Building for her. A Rutgers University residential building in Newark, New Jersey, became Ruth Bader Ginsburg Hall. Elsewhere in the world, Canada, France, Spain, prime ministers and presidents joined in the tributes. Ginsburg had been a fine judge, unswerving in her calls for justice and human rights. Some of the dissents she wrote during her final years on the Supreme Court may well become guideposts for future decisions. That, however, did not differentiate her from other former members of the nation's highest court. What made her distinctive was not her distinguished career as a jurist, but her work in the 1970s, long before she became a member of the Supreme Court. Turning to those years, Rabbi Holtzblatt eulogized Ginsburg as a prophet. "It's the rare prophet," she said at the Supreme Court ceremony, "who not only imagines a new world, but also makes that new world a reality in her lifetime." That is what Ginsburg did. Imagine a world, or at least a nation, in which women possessed the legal opportunity to do everything done by men. It was her phenomenally successful work as an advocate for equal rights for women that led to the extraordinary expressions of grief and to the celebrations of her life. And it is that work that this book is about. The landmark cases that played a crucial role in changing the laws of the United States. The story of those cases would be incomplete without some background information about the way in which Ginsburg became a woman's rights advocate, and how that affected her litigation strategy. Every story about the law, after all, is as much about the people in it as it is about legal doctrines. This book, however, is in no way meant as a biography of Ginsburg in her prejudicial years. Similarly, an important part of the tale concerns the American Civil Liberties Union, which enabled Ginsburg to bring the gender equality cases, and the evolution of that organization into one supportive of women's rights. But this certainly is not a history of the ACLU either. Instead, the primary focus is on the cases themselves. A book of this length necessarily involves choices about what to include and what to leave out. Among the things for which space was inadequate are the contributions of dozens, if not hundreds, of other women, men, and civil society organizations to the push for legal gender equality in the years covered here. I mentioned some of them, but apologize for having to leave to others the full story of how important they were. Ginsburg, as she would have been the first to say, did not do it alone. In 1978, Ginsburg gave a keynote address at a West Virginia University women's conference. Looking back into American history, she told the conferees that the Constitution was viewed by jurists until well past this century's midpoint as a virtually empty cupboard for sex equality claims. What follows is the story of how that changed. Chapter 1. Beginnings. There were some 160,000 lawyers in the United States in 1933, but only about 3,400 of them, less than 2.5%, were women. So no one could predict when Joan Ruth Bader was born on March 15, 1933, a rainy wind lashed day in New York City, that she would someday join their ranks. In fact, she almost didn't. Joan Ruth was the second child of Celia Amster Bader, a Queens homemaker and bookkeeper, and Nathan Bader, a small businessman. Both parents were Jewish immigrants, Nathan from Russia, Celia from Poland. Although, as she arrived in her mother's womb and was born in the United States, she was not technically an immigrant. Celia graduated from a New York high school at age 15, but her family was poor. Boys took precedence over girls, and Celia had to give up her hopes for more education and go to work so her brother could attend college. A year after Joan Ruth's birth, the Baders' 6-year-old daughter, Marilyn, died from spinal meningitis. The grief-stricken parents moved their family away from a place of sad memories and to a new home in Brooklyn. Their surviving daughter, soon known as Ruth because there were too many Jones in her kindergarten class, became a true Brooklynite. "I went to Ebbets Field religiously to cheer for the Brooklyn Dodgers," she would remember. Sports fervor didn't prevent her from excelling in the local elementary school. She graduated from PS 238 at the top of her class. At James Madison High School, she again earned high grades, but she also found time for baton twirling on the school cheerleading squad and playing cello in the school orchestra. She played the piano as well. Ruth was one of the top students picked to speak at Madison's graduation ceremony on June 27, 1950. She didn't get to the graduation, however, because 2 days earlier, tragedy struck the Bader household once again. Celia Bader lost a years-long battle with cancer. She remained a guiding force in her daughter's life nonetheless. When Ginsburg was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court, she said about herself and her mother, "I pray that I may be all that she would have been had she lived in an age when women could aspire and achieve, and daughters are cherished as much as sons." Ginsburg frequently spoke about other important influences in her life. One was books. Celia Bader instilled a love of reading and learning by taking her daughter to the public library every Friday afternoon and allowing her to choose the 3 books she would devour that week in addition to her schoolwork. Ginsburg remembered being inspired by the poet Emma Lazarus because of her love for humankind, and Henrietta Szold, the feminist who founded the Jewish Women's Charitable Health Organization called Hadassah. The little girl became a believer in human rights quite early. An editorial she wrote as an eighth grader in 1946 lauded the new United Nations Charter and placed it in a line of important documents such as the Ten Commandments and the Declaration of Independence. Some influences were a matter of simple chance, as were some of the teachers she encountered, and a particularly important blind date. The teachers were at Cornell University, which she attended on scholarships from 1950 to 1954. One day, she went to the office of Robert E. Cushman, the noted scholar with whom she took a constitutional law course, hoping that he could help her make sense of the House Un-American Activities Committee's 1950s hearings into alleged communists. Realizing her potential, Cushman asked the young student to become his research assistant and eventually suggested that she consider going to law school. While at Cornell, she also took a course in European literature with Vladimir Nabokov, whom she credited, along with Cushman, with having taught her to write succinctly. Nabokov, she said, changed the way I read, the way I write. His teaching would stand her in good stead once she began litigating. When writing a brief, she said, "You have to keep it simple. You have to remember that judges are overwhelmed with reading case briefs." So it was my aim to try to write a brief that could be made the opinion of the court. The blind date that proved to be so consequential was with fellow Cornell student Martin D. Ginsburg, known as Marty. He became first her best friend and then her husband. "I had the great good fortune to marry a man who thought my work was as important as his," she would say, describing him as the only man she dated who was interested in her brain. They married in 1954, a week after her graduation from Cornell, continuing a love affair that ended only with Marty's death in 2010. "I have had more than a little bit of luck in life," she wrote later, "but nothing equals in magnitude my marriage to Martin D. Ginsburg." The newly married couple moved to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where Marty fulfilled his 2-year Army service obligation, and their daughter, Jane, was born. The Ginsburgs had long planned to go to graduate school together once Marty's Army service was over. He was a year ahead of Ruth in school, so he would begin graduate school earlier. Their first choice was the Harvard Business School, which Marty favored. But they discovered that it would not admit women. The Harvard Law School, however, had begun accepting women in 1950. The idea of going there appealed to Ruth. Her work with Professor Cushman had made her think that lawyers could be consequential, and that a career in the law might be a way to contribute to society. And so, because of the business school's disdain for women, Ruth Bader Ginsburg got the legal education that would set the stage for her to become one of the nation's most consequential attorneys. She entered Harvard in the fall of 1956, one of 10 women in a law school class of roughly 500. One woman dropped out after the first year, so the number is usually given as 9. Ginsburg would note later that women were then less than 3% of American lawyers, and that they were as much of an anomaly at the Harvard Law School as they were in the legal profession at large. Their secondary status was reflected in something as seemingly trivial as bathrooms. The law school held classes in 2 buildings, but only one of them, Austin Hall, had a women's room, and it was down in the basement. Nancy Boxley Tepper, one of the only women in the class before Ginsburg's, remembered it as a janitor's bathroom. "That made it pretty tough if you were taking a class in the other building, in Langdale. Worse if you were taking an exam," Ginsburg recalled. "Yet we never complained. That was just the way it was." The paucity of women's rooms was but one indication of the law school's resistance to the presence of women in what had formerly been exclusively the ranks of men. The male students gave the female students derogatory nicknames.
The criminal law professors deliberately embarrass them by calling upon them to describe rape cases in intimate detail. Because there were so few women, most sections just had two women, and you felt that every eye was on you, Ginsburg remembered. Every time you went to answer a question, you were answering for your entire sex. It may not have been true, but certainly you felt that way. You were different, and the object of curiosity. Erwin Griswold was the dean of the law school when Ginsburg arrived in Cambridge. Every year, he held a dinner for the new female students, assigning a male faculty member as an escort for each woman. It didn't occur to Griswold that a woman student might be married, or, as Ginsburg was when she arrived at Harvard, the mother of a 14-month-old child. After dinner in Ginsburg's year, the group retired to the Griswolds' living room. Ginsburg was seated next to her escort, the legal scholar Herbert Wexler. Smoking was still fashionable then, and Ginsburg held their joint ashtray on her lap as Griswold asked each of the women why they were in law school, occupying a seat that could be held by a man. As Ginsburg remembered, "I rose when called on, and there went the cigarette butts, spread about the rug in front of me. If only I had a button to push so I could vanish through a trap door." I mumbled something about my husband being in the second year class and how important it was for a wife to understand her husband's work. I didn't mean to say that, but that's what came out. Years later, Ginsburg came to believe that Griswold actually favored having women at the law school and asked the question to gather ammunition when he was challenged by other faculty members. Ginsburg thrived at Harvard in spite of that contretemps, earning grades so high that she was invited to serve on the Harvard Law Review, the prestigious journal published by the law school's best students. When she was chosen as one of its editors, she decided to take her mother-in-law to the review's annual banquet at the Harvard Club in Boston. The club, however, maintained a strict men-only policy and refused to make an exception for anyone other than the two women students who had been elected to the law review. When Marty graduated from Harvard in 1958, he landed a job with a New York City law firm, and Ruth transferred to Columbia Law School for her final year. There, she earned grades that once again put her at the top of her class. She was one of a dozen women in a class of roughly 300, and the only woman in her class to make law review. That record made no difference when it came to getting a job. She applied to law firm after law firm, signing up for every interview I could get, but none wanted a woman. Marty Ginsburg remembered that one firm told her, "We had a woman once, but it didn't work out." Ginsburg would later say she had three strikes against her. She was a woman, Jewish, and a mother. Top law school students commonly clerk for a judge after graduation. The distinguished legal scholar Gerald Gunther, one of Ginsburg's Columbia professors, considered her to be a brilliant student who demonstrated extraordinary intellectual capacities. Charged with obtaining clerkships for graduating Columbia law students, Gunther might well have considered Ginsburg to be an obvious choice. When that proved not to be true, with one federal judge after another declining to hire a woman, he turned to Judge Edmund L. Palmieri of the Federal District Court in Manhattan. Palmieri hired only Columbia clerks recommended by Gunther, but, he said, he had no place for a woman with a 4-year-old child. Gunther told Palmieri that if he didn't hire Ginsburg, Gunther would never again send him any other potential clerk. The professor suggested a compromise. Palmieri would hire Ginsburg, but Gunther would arrange for another male Columbia graduate to take leave from his Wall Street firm if Ginsburg didn't work out. She did work out and clerked for Palmieri for 2 years. The male backup presumably remained at his firm. Once Ginsburg had completed her clerkship with Palmieri, the logical next step was to apply for a U.S. Supreme Court clerkship as did many young lawyers who had clerked for a lower court judge. Albert M. Sachs, another of her former Columbia professors, tried to get her a clerkship with Justice Felix Frankfurter, but Frankfurter was horrified at the idea of a woman lawyer working in his chambers. Fortunately, a quite different kind of opportunity appeared. Columbia's law school had created a project on international procedure that examined codes of procedure in other countries in order to educate American attorneys about them. The project's director invited Ginsburg to work for it as a research assistant for a while she learned Swedish, and then to go to Sweden to study and write about the Swedish code with a Swedish judge as her co-author. Ginsburg took the job, and in 1962, now reasonably proficient in Swedish, she began living intermittently in Stockholm. One result was the more than a dozen articles and books about the Swedish legal system that she wrote over the next few years. Ginsburg's Swedish experience had an even more significant effect on her. "My eyes were opened up in Sweden," she later said. "Unlike the situation in the United States, women made up about a quarter of law students, and the country was immersed in a discussion about why women should have two jobs, workplace and home, while men only had one. The Swedish government began to take measures to undo sex role stereotypes, introducing parental leave for men and affirmative action for both sexes." At the same time, Ginsburg read feminist Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, which she called an eye-opener. She would mentally file the book and the Swedish model away for later use. "I put it all on a back burner until the late 60s, when the women's movement came alive in the United States." Ginsburg returned to the United States for good in 1963 and found a country in transition. The 1950s was the era of the Civil Rights Revolution, one outcome of the marching and demonstrating and litigating by Black Americans and their allies was the Supreme Court's landmark Brown v. Board of Education decision of 1954, declaring that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. The Civil Rights Movement, along with Brown and its progeny, helped awaken many Americans to the damage done by policies of exclusion. Exclusion stigmatized. Exclusion denied equal opportunities for employment and participation in civil life, as well as for education. Suddenly, equality and equal opportunity were part of the national conversation. Women activists were determined to include gender inequalities in the discussion, and in the next few years, many of them would set their sights on the workplace. By the 1960s, the reality of life had changed from what it was decades earlier for many American women. 40% of all women over the age of 16 were in the paid workforce. That number included 30% of married women and 39% of women with children aged 6 to 17. More women than ever were going to college. 53% of those who graduated held paid jobs. Employment outside the home was no longer the domain of women who had to work for economic reasons, although many of them did, as the post-World War II inflation had made a second income necessary for many families. Historian William Chafe noted that by the 1960s, a growing number of women appeared to value a job for its own sake and for the personal rewards it conferred. The home remained a central focus of female life, but it had ceased to be the only focus. Women were now freer to take control of their employment and other aspects of their lives by planning their pregnancies. On June 23, 1960, the Federal Food and Drug Administration approved the sale of an oral contraceptive. Within 2 years, 1.2 million American women were using the pill. By 1965, that number had grown to 6.5 million, and one out of every four wives under the age of 45 had used it. The effect on women's aspirations was nothing short of revolutionary. Their control of a society that still treated women very differently from men, however, was not as great, and many clamored for the government to do something about it. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy, bowing to growing public sentiment, appointed former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt as chair of a new President's Commission on the Status of Women. Its report, American Women, was published in 1963. The voluminous document detailed the extent to which American women were deprived of equal rights and equal opportunities. Simultaneously, Congress finally enacted the 1963 Equal Pay Act, which had been introduced in one form or another since the 1940s. The first federal law to ban sex discrimination, it mandated equal wages for men and women doing equal work. It was limited in scope and largely honored in the breach, but it was indicative of changing social mores. That same year, Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, a powerful indictment of the separate spheres ideology that left so many American women out of public life and confined to a private one that was less than fulfilling. The year 1963 also witnessed the March on Washington, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s stirring I Have a Dream speech. Congress, beginning to catch up with the civil rights movement and what was still a contested but increasingly powerful new societal focus on equality, started to debate the proposed 1964 Civil Rights Act. Title VII of the Act, as originally written, prohibited employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, and national origin, but not sex. That was not acceptable to some of the newer women legislators who had entered Congress in the last decade. Like Congresswoman Martha Griffiths, who had been elected from Michigan in 1955, they initially hoped that the Supreme Court would use the 14th Amendment to begin striking down statutory gender inequality. That had not happened. There never was a time when decisions of the Supreme Court could not have done everything we ask today, Griffiths would tell Congress in 1970, speaking in favor of the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. The text of the proposed amendment is, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The court has held for 98 years that women, as a class, are not entitled to equal protection of the laws, Griffiths said. They are not persons within the meaning of the Constitution. She was referring to the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, enacted in 1868 following the Civil War. The amendment says, in part, no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Back in 1963, believing that the legislature would have to do what the court would not, Griffiths and her colleagues maneuvered successfully to include the word sex in Title VII. Title VII created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission with a mandate to investigate claims of employment discrimination. The new commission focused on race discrimination and paid little attention to sex discrimination. Herman Edelsberg, its executive director, called the addition of sex in the law a fluke that was conceived out of wedlock. The commission's lack of interest in the workplace problems that women faced was so flagrant that a primarily but not exclusively female group of participants in the 1966 federally sponsored Third Annual Conference on the Status of Women walked out of the conference and, gathering in a nearby hotel room, created the National Organization for Women. Other civil society organizations devoted to gender equality followed in the next few years. Things were slowly changing in the society at large, and in a small and very incomplete way, so were law schools. In 1963, soon after Ginsburg returned to New York from Sweden, Columbia Law School professor Walter Gellhorn told her that Rutgers University Law School in Newark was looking for someone to teach civil procedure. She got the job, which also involved teaching comparative law and federal jurisdiction. After some months at Rutgers,
sample complete. Ready to continue?